Good morning, everyone. At the outset, I would like to highlight that in today's gospel, we have the famous John 3:16 passage. Now, as a kid who grew up in a Christian tradition that emphasized biblical literacy, I think I had this verse memorized before I knew how to add and subtract numbers. It is seen as a centerpiece for how many Christians understand salvation, believe in Jesus, get saved, because God sent Jesus to save you. So let's just keep that in mind. We are dealing with a foundational text of modern Christianity. As a father of three kids, I have found myself subjected to watching more Marvel movies than I care to mention. It was just last week that I found myself sitting on the couch with Eli and Eden and watching again one of the Thor series. Now, I mean no offense to Marvel comic fans, but these movies tend to drive me nuts. They force ancient mythologies into these two-hour sagas with the usual tropes of quick romance and fireballs of violence. The Thor series cast actors such as Anthony Hopkins, Idris Elba, Natalie Portman, and Chris Hemsworth. The series revolve around loosely referenced Norse mythology involving Thor and his magic hammer, Odin and his fatherly wisdom, and Loki's mischievous ways. Now, I believe, and let me share my screen to at least depict this. I believe in this trifecta of cinematic mashup, Thor, i.e. Chris Hemsworth, is shirtless at least once in every single one. I mean, after all, Thor is the hero. He undergoes this typical hero's journey, this Bildungsroman-esque type character of transformations. He goes from hubris to humility. And as I watched the third movie, yes, there are three, as I watched the third movie, Ragnarok, a reference to the virtual end of the world mythology in the Norse, I started to notice some generalities. Number one, the movies thrive on sibling rivalry. Just like Genesis, I might add, there is this rivalry between our wonderfully good-looking Thor here and his brother, Loki. And two, I noticed another generality, that the plot circulates this father-son relationship complex. The all-knowing father educates the chosen son until the son is ready to be king through self-sacrifice. Very similar motifs to Jesus and his father, I might add. But the movie is Hollywood typical. The bulging bicep Thor wins through a kind of bumbling violence with erratic moments of insight or luck. But that's not why I mentioned Thor today. To be frank, I'm more interested in Loki. Let me see if I can give you a picture here of Loki. There he is. So, as you can probably guess, our modern Hollywood Loki is on the right. The more ancient version of Loki is on the left. Hollywood characterizes him as a self-serving, weak, snake-like creature. I mean, look, he even has horns. He's devilish. But of course, Loki is a mythic character, with centuries of ideas swirling around his persona. In short, Loki is a trickster. In ancient cosmology, evidently Loki's parentage were of the giants, those who lived outside the gates and walls of Asgard, the home of Loki's adopted father, Odin. Asgard's this place of light and immortality. It is separated with the rest of the created order by walls. But Loki, in the mythology, seems to move back and forth between the world of giants and Asgard. He's known as a shapeshifter. To some extent, and relevant to today's biblical texts, I promise I'm going to get there, Loki is associated with snakes. Norse mythology says he has a son who is a giant snake that is large enough to encircle the world and eat his own tail. Among the references to Loki's son, and I'm going to work on the pronunciation here, Jormungandr, one particular narrative involves Thor wielding his hammer and battling this giant snake. Again, it's starting to sound like sibling rivalry. Thor kills the giant snake, but also dies, succumbing to the venom of this snake. You can see one depiction here on the left. It's a depiction from an 11th century Altuna runestone. The engravings have been highlighted in red. You can see Thor up at the top wielding his hammer. He doesn't look as bicep-alicious as our actor in Hollywood, but you can see he's there in his boat and the snake is below. Now, I don't have the time to delve into the specifics, but you may be hearing interesting resonances between Norse mythology and our own Christian thematics. For now, I will merely note that early Christians heard similar patterns and even integrated them into their own symbology. Note, for example, on the right here in this picture, a 10th century Anglo-Saxon cross, which has part of Thor's battle with this snake, among other Norse mythologies, etched in the cross. Now, Loki is a trickster. Cultures around the world have these personas. In a wonderful book called Trickster Makes This World, Lewis Hyde investigates the trickster found in ancient stories. From Native American stories about the coyote to the Norse mythology of Loki, tricksters are characters that seem to live in two worlds. They are border crossers. They transition between two worlds. They transgress institutional and divinely sanctioned boundaries and categories. They are wise and cunning. In his book, Hyde notes that the trickster plays with the distinction between accident and essence, or coincidence and significance. You know, tricksters are hard to trust. They are constantly violating sanctioned rule and laws. They flirt with our established order. And for this reason, I believe tricksters are often associated, like Loki, with snakes. They seem to exist in a kind of other world. Slithering out of holes in the ground, they surprise us. They scare us. And they can be truly dangerous. Now, why in the world am I delving, superficially at best, into Norse mythology, and why did I subject you to, first, those pictures, and Hollywood's version of it? Well, I think Hollywood got something wrong. But I think it relates to how we also get something wrong with our own Christian understanding of Jesus. So let's look at our own serpentine biblical text today. What I'd like to do is throw a smooth stone over the whole biblical text and see where it skips. So hang with me. Scene one, we start in the Garden of Eden. Eve is tempted by a serpent who is called, quote, the wisest of the animals. Now let's move very quickly, centuries, perhaps thousands of years, to scene two. We're now in Egypt. Israel has been subjugated to slave control by Egypt, and God has called Moses to let his people go. Moses uses Aaron, and they go to Pharaoh, and they start the proclamation, let Israel go. Pharaoh says, show me that you have some power. So what does Aaron do? Well, in Exodus 7, he throws down his staff, and it becomes a snake. Interesting, because that snake, that staff that becomes snake, is thrown down in front of a Pharaoh who wears the uraeus. You can see this image here of a crown. It's a crown with raised cobras, symbols of what? Divine power, wedded to empire. And what happens to this staff turned snake? Pharaoh says, I can do that too. His magicians turn staffs into snakes. But what does Aaron's snake do specifically? It eats Pharaoh's snakes. Okay, so let's jump ahead. And now we are back to what we read today. Scene 3. Let me stop sharing my screen here. We're back now to scene 3. Scene 3 is going to put us right in Numbers. What's happening? What's happening right now in Numbers? We have everyone trying to figure out how to get out of the desert. Let me find that passage. The Israelites cross the Red Sea, and they start complaining about how crappy the desert is, about how Egypt was better. And what happens? Snakes begin to kill the people. God tells Moses to craft a bronze snake and raise it on a pole. The people look at the snake and are cured. Now, as strange as that text is, I want to keep moving on, despite its difficulty. Because centuries later, that same bronze staff evidently is still around, because in the time of King Hezekiah and 2 Kings, he's told to purge essentially the idolatrous actions of Israel, and he goes around finding ancient relics of idolatry and destroying them. And you know what he does? He finds the bronze snake. And, quote, he removed the high places, smashed the sacred stones, and cut the Asherah poles. He broke into pieces the bronze snake Moses had, for up to that time, the Israelites had been burning incense to it. Now let's really skip ahead. Last skip, I promise. All the way to John. There's Jesus. And he cryptically describes himself as this bronze snake. Coming before the great evangelical text of John 3:16, we are told that the Son of Man will, like the bronze snake, be lifted up for the salvation of all. Now that's a whirlwind of contradictions. How in the world am I to understand Jesus as both venomous snake that kills and emblazoned snake that heals? How am I to understand this pole, this cross, that saves? Well, I would like to ask, what if Jesus is less like Thor and more like Loki? What if Jesus is a kind of unique trickster? What kind of boundaries does this trickster transgress? Here's a few that come to mind. Love your enemies. Turn the other cheek. Find God in the margins. Give up all that you possess. Forgive those who wrong you. Deny the borders of your self-interest. Now, last week, Jesus upended the marketplace religion. Jesus, the trickster, shifts or deconstructs our notions of God. He goes into the institutional heart of religion and turns it over. As a trickster, Jesus destabilizes our notion of God. For Jesus, God is the ultimate word for a great negation, not a thing, not a created category, not an image. Jesus the trickster illuminates that God is an intangible stirring within, a connection of events swirling around love. God is an event that we succumb to. God is a movement beyond the categorical. God does not live in the temple, nor does God live in church. Tyrannical Christianity tries to maintain a notion of purism. Tyrannical religion builds walls and maintains supposedly static narratives. We are told outside those walls are devilish syncretistic energies, unholy mixings. But this is a deceit. We do not and cannot live as first century hermits maintaining a religion that does not change. We understand stories only with other stories. We understand our own lives only through other stories and other lives. There is always a fine line between coincidence and significance, between accident and essence. And sometimes those lines collapse. We build the walls and Jesus tears them down. Please remember, Christ was crucified outside the city gate. Jesus the trickster fiddles with our notions of who is in and who is out, with our simple definitions of power, of categories that stabilize our own hubris. Jesus reminds us that God is a trans, a movement across boundaries. Being a follower of Jesus is indeed tricky business. The cross of Christ has been lifted up for centuries. Christ as the bronze serpent. But Jesus is a trickster. Remember, that pole is empty. The line between death and life was also transgressed. During the Lenten period, we are reminded that we are always living within this transition. The empty pole, the empty tomb, remind us that we follow a trickster. A divine figure that transgresses those lines of separation with the cataclysmic prospect that all, every single thing, can be joined together. The cross of Christ is not meant to be treated as a thing, as a bronze pole relic housing the divine. No, the cross of Christ is an event. It is a moment that orbits around a divine stirring. And if we raise that cross, then we open our willingness to break apart that which is imprisoned. So the cross of Christ is indeed a kind of hammer, one in which even Thor would be jealous.